On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Chee, Mr. Curtis Franklin here today. Now, the digital divide is fierce, especially in rural America, and there's an initiative out there that aims to improve this drastically by 2021. We'll talk about it in just how effective it could be. Plus, we've had a lot of audience members here who manage networks. That's right. It's not easy, and there are risks and costs that are invisible to you. Well, today we have Jeff Gray. He's CEO and co-founder of Glueware, and he's going to take us through the landscape and just how automation might be able to bring it back to level playing field. Should be cool. Definitely shouldn't miss that. Twiet on This Day.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 462, recorded September 24th, 2021. Glue up your network. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Melissa. The U.S. Postal Service processes more than 98,000 address changes daily. Is your customer contact data up to date? Try Melissa's APIs in a developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records clean for free at melissa.com/twit. And by Thinks Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And by CrowdStrike. CrowdStrike harnesses the power of every click, every action, and every ally to grow stronger and stop cyber threats before they can stop you. Join the fight and experience the power of Falcon Platform for free today at CrowdStrike.com/TWIT. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide to this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring you through into this world and through this world with some of the greatest experts and professionals in the field, starting with our very own network and security experts and all-around tech geek. He's Mr. Brian Chee. Chiebert, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, though I'm still trying to find stuff after the big move from Hawaii to Orlando. The latest thing I'm looking for is fiber optic cleaning gear. And I found my OTDR, I found my power meter, I found all my SC cleaning kit, but I can't find my LC. So I'm trying to clean up some fiber optics from this new AT&T fiber drop, but no cleaning kit. Darn. Oh, well, I'll find it eventually.
I tell you one thing. I think I'm still looking for my sanity as part of this move. But we'll see if I find that sometime soon. Well, speaking of finding something great, we also have Mr. Curtis Franken. He's an enterprise security expert, and he's also a senior analyst at Omdia. Curtis, what's going on for you in this week, and what's keeping you busy?
Well, I was just going to tell Brian, I don't have any of that fancy fiber stuff, but I do have some Brillo under the sink. I can bring it down. I'm sure it'll clean that fiber right on up. As for me, I'm heading out to the desert again, going to IWCE, where we'll be talking about critical infrastructure communications and the communications for first responders and other emergency workers. But I'm going to be part of three different panels out there, so I'm really looking forward to those conversations. In addition, we've got lots of conferences starting to pop for the fall, both in person and virtual. So I'm going to be attending the conferences for a number of different companies, vendors out there, as well as, with a little bit of luck, the ISC Squared Global Congress. That's always a good time and a lot of good information on security. So plenty of things to keep me hopping. And oh, by the way, I'm running a pair of foot races tomorrow morning, so it's beginning to feel a lot like fall here in Florida.
Well, good luck with that. Well, speaking of keeping things hopping, we definitely have a large, long week of enterprise news, so it definitely should jump right in. And the digital divide is pretty fierce, especially if you're in rural America. Well, there's a new initiative out there that aims to improve that drastically by 2022. We'll talk about it and just how effective it just might be. Plus, we have a lot of audience members who manage their networks, and it's not that easy, right? Well, there are lots of risks and costs that go around it. Sometimes some of them are not visible, and CIOs and CTOs and even CISOs alike struggle to manage those risks. Well, today we have Jeff Gray. He's CEO and co-founder of Glueware. He's going to take us through the landscape and just how automation might be able to bring us back to the level playing field in that area. We'll talk about that. So sit tight. We have lots to talk about. But first, like we always do, let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now it's release day for iPhone 13. That's right. What better way to celebrate your new shiny iPhone than a nice set of brand new exploits? That's right. A security researcher published the details of three vulnerabilities that affect up-to-date iPhones, which could be used by a malicious app to gather personal information. What else could it do? Now, the researchers wrote a blog post and also published the source code on GitHub that allows for others to take full advantage of the vulnerabilities. I wonder why they did that. Now, the blog post and source code give other security researchers, as well as malicious hackers, the ability to reproduce the unpatched vulnerabilities and exploit them, according to the researchers. Other researchers have actually analyzed the disclosed bugs. Now, the question is, why did the researcher decide to go public instead of work with Apple? Well, he decided to go public to share their frustrating experience, quote, participating in Apple's security bounty program. Here's a bit more from the researcher to add some more context. Quote, I've reported 4 zero-day vulnerabilities this year between March 10th and May 5th or May 4th. As of now, 3 of them are still present in the latest iOS version, and 1 was fixed in 14.7. But Apple decided to cover it up and not list it on the security page. When I confronted them, they apologized, assured me it happened due to a processing issue, and promised to list it on the security content page of the next update. Now, there's some good news here. The good news is, according to another security firm, these bugs cannot be used on their own to hack an iPhone remotely. Now, on the other hand, they indeed break the sandbox restrictions like getting Apple ID or ability to list all installed apps or getting access to contacts. But a malicious attacker can use these exploits, of course, but it requires a malicious application to be installed on the victim's device. Now, getting malware on the Apple App Store is really hard, extremely hard, and there have been very few cases of that happening. Now, the question remains, why is Apple so slow to fix or publicize their vulnerabilities? Well, why won't they give it security researchers the credit for the issues? And also, why is this happening? Well, it seems to me Apple's security bounty program might need an overhaul here, or they might find themselves in more hot water in the coming months.
Well, speaking of giving researchers credit, researchers from Google's Threat Analysis Group, or TAG, have spotted what they describe as a new technique by a financially motivated attacker to sneak adware and other unwanted software past malware detection tools. In a blog post this week, Google researcher Neil Mehta described the threat actor as using a software code signing certificate from a legitimate certificate authority to create signatures that can't be decoded or inspected by security tools that use OpenSSL code. But, and this is important, they are accepted as valid by Windows. Now, the attacker has been using these signatures to distribute OpenS Updater, a known malware family that's used to install other unwanted and potentially harmful software on infected systems. The operator of OpenS Updater has been observed trying to infect as many systems as possible in what seems to be an opportunistic campaign before the fixes are put in. Now, for quite some time, attackers have used stolen or otherwise illegally obtained digital certificates to bypass malware detection tools and extend the ability of their malware to stay undetected on compromised systems and networks. What's different with OpenS Updater is its use of a deliberately malformed signature to evade detection. Since at least mid-August, the author of the malware has been signing OpenS Updater samples with a signature that's been edited in a way that OpenSSL-based security products can't parse or decode. Groups of OpenS Updater samples have been observed to be signed with the same malformed signature, according to Meta. And this is the first time that TAG has observed a threat actor using a deliberately malformed digital signature to evade malware detection tools.
All right, so this article appeared in Ars Technica just this week. It is something I need to bring up, but it's a little one-sided. So take this with a little dash of salt, please. So Facebook had it rough last week. Leaked documents, many leaked documents, formed the backbone of a string of reports published in the Wall Street Journal. Together, the stories paint the picture of a company barely in control of its own creation. The revelations run the gamut. Facebook has created special rules for VIPs that largely exempted 5.8 million users from moderation, forced troll farm content on 40% of America, and created toxic conditions for teen girls while ignoring cartels and human traffickers, and even undermined CEO Mark Zuckerberg's own desire to promote vaccination against COVID. Now, the opinion. Facebook wants you to know it's sorry and it's trying to do better. Quote, in the past, we didn't address safety and security challenges early enough in the product development process, unquote. The company said in an unsigned press release today. Quote, instead, we made improvements reactively in response to a specific abuse, but we have fundamentally changed that approach. Well, the change, Facebook said, was the integration of safety and security into product development. The press release doesn't say when the change was made, and the Facebook spokesperson doesn't confirm for Ars Technica when integrity became more embedded in the product teams. But the press release does say the company's Facebook Horizon VR efforts benefited from the process. That was released to beta only last year. Anyway, the release would appear to confirm that prior to development of Horizon, safety and security were sideshows that were considered after features had been defined and code had been written. Or maybe problems weren't addressed until even later when users encountered them. Regardless of what happened, it's kind of a stunning revelation for a multi-billion dollar company that counts 2 billion people as users.
Now, this was an interesting piece written by the IEEE organization that I belong to as an electrical engineer. Now, it might spark a knee-jerk reaction to some organizations, but to a purchaser of devices like IT, it makes sense. Now, manufacturers should maintain their software and firmware indefinitely. It's an interesting quote there. Now, let that sink in for a second. Now, the journalist who wrote the article points out numerous devices in arm's length, for example, like their Nokia N95 or a proto smartphone, the first sport GPS. Another was an Android tablet relic, or another one being their beloved Sony PlayStation Portable, all out of service and all out of warranty there. These nifty antiques shared a common problem. Although each booted up and successfully, none of them really worked anymore. Now, the point being, device makers are apt to drop support for old gadgets faster than gadgets themselves wear out. Now, consumers have relied on the good graces of device makers to keep our gadget firmware and software secure and up to date. Now, doing so costs the manufacturers lots of profits. Now, as a result, many of them are apt to drop support for old gadgets faster than the gadgets themselves wear out. And we have seen global right to repair movements emerge from maker communities and start to influence public policy around such things as the availability of spare parts. However, there's a position presented here that there should be a parallel right to maintain movement. Pretty interesting. Now, we should mandate that device manufacturers set aside a portion of their purchase price of a gadget to support ongoing software maintenance, forcing them to budget for a future they'd rather ignore. Or maybe they aren't ignoring the future so much as trying to manage by speeding up product obsolescence, because it typically sparks another purchase from you. That's right. It brings a good point here. Now, how fast can a device maker let their devices get stale on software? What if they are vulnerable? Are they liable? Or as the device owner. And personally, I think a bit of regulation couldn't hurt here. Plus, it would make sure that manufacturers of any device are required to actually support the good and the bad devices. Now, the question is, should they still support your Super Nintendo? Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Melissa. Now, having accurate customer address data is crucial for the success of your business. Did you know that nearly 36 million address changes were processed by the USPS in 2020? And one of those was mine, of course. And that's a huge chunk of customers you can miss out on. 30% of customer data goes bad each year, but Melissa can help make sure your data is current and accurate. Melissa's tools have helped businesses maintain fresh data for over 35 years, which explains why over 10,000 businesses trust the address experts. And Melissa has a renewal rate of over 92%. Now, what does that mean? Well, that's just proof that companies love Melissa, and you will too. Now you can verify addresses, emails, phone numbers, and names in real time with Melissa. Now, Melissa's global address verification service verifies addresses for over 240 countries and territories at the point of entry. Now, tired of having duplicate customer information in your database? Well, with Melissa's data matching, you can eliminate clutter and duplicates and increase the accuracy of your database and reduce postage and mailing costs. Get the information that completes your customer profiles better. Add consumer demographic info to your records, such as marital status or even social media handles. Melissa's flexible deployment options offer different platforms to suit any preferences, business size, or budget. Now, with flexible on-premise web service, secure FTP processing, and software as a service delivery options, Melissa also has their new Lookups app, iOS and Google, to search addresses, names, and more just at your fingertips. And Melissa's continually undergoing independent security audits to reinforce their commitment to data security, privacy, and compliance requirements. They are SOC 2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant. That's right. Plus, when you do need support, Melissa's Global Support Center offers 24/7 world-renowned support if you sign up for their service level agreement. Inquire today. And Melissa is still supporting communities and qualifying essential workers during COVID-19. See if your organization qualifies for 6 months of free service by applying online at melissa.com. Now, we'd also like to congratulate Melissa for being named a leader in address verification and data quality by G2 Crowd in their spring 2021 report. Make sure your customer content data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. And we thank Melissa for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, this bite is interesting because we talk a lot about the digital divide and, you know, internet access and making it useful and available to people in, like, let's say, rural areas or inner city urban areas or even in other countries that might not have the internet they need to run their daily lives or even run their businesses. So I'm going to toss this over to Cheaper because there's a new interesting program going on that might just help. Cheaper, what is it?
Well, and I'm actually driving this one because otherwise it's going to sound like Lou's tooting his own horn. This is actually a Microsoft initiative. And the cool thing is it's actually the whole concept is very near and dear to my heart. I've been part of a wireless internet service provider. Now, for those of you that weren't able to make it to Wispapalooza, which is a physical convention in Las Vegas, put on by the Wireless Internet Service Provider Association. Now, we did have their CEO on a little while back. In fact, that just for your reference, it was Claude Akins and was back in episode 345. Now, so here's the trick. We all agree that the internet and access to the internet is a very big deal, no matter where you live, whether it's in America, West Africa, South Africa, doesn't matter. The internet is the way a lot of things are happening. Now, not only is it education, it's also business, being able to get to the information, get to the products that you're trying to sell or buy. So it's an important thing. So what's happening is Microsoft has an initiative. They're calling it Airband. And what I'd actually like to do is there's a map that we can bring up that this is very obviously US centric, but it shows where the Microsoft Airband project is really starting to happen within the continental US and of course America, Alaska and Hawaii. So the colors, the dark blue or the lighter blue, is where Microsoft Airband is really starting to happen. So as part of the article that Microsoft did, there's a really cool couple of paragraphs. Quote, last year, a team of Amish-owned horses dragged the load up a ridge near Essex, New York. It was a normal scene for rural America, straight out of a Norman Rockwell painting, except they were wearing telecommunications equipment to connect the local community to the internet. Now, Essex is barely 12 miles across the lake from Burlington, Vermont, but broadband is scarce. In our increasingly digital and interconnected world, broadband is as important as electricity or water. Rural communities without broadband face higher unemployment rates and see fewer educational and economic opportunities. For the women overseeing the horses, Beth Schiller, CEO of CV Wireless LLC, this is a solvable problem. Together with Microsoft's Airband initiative, she's bringing connectivity to her community. Now, the article goes on to say that in the summer of 2017, Microsoft launched the Airband initiative to bring wireless broadband connectivity, well, actually broadband connectivity to people living in underserved rural areas. Now, I think we can all agree that a lot of these rural communities are not served by the big ISPs because it's too expensive. You know, the typical cost for a utility pole is about $5,000 to put in the ground. So when you start adding those up by the thousands of poles you need to bring internet into rural communities, especially farm communities where your next neighbor might be several miles down, I can understand why the giant ISPs are saying, well, maybe this isn't a good business case. So what's happening is the wireless internet service providers, and in this case, Microsoft and a few other folks, are stepping in and saying, well, if the business case isn't going to work, let's start saying, let's make the world a better place. And so what's happening is there's lots of initiatives happening. Now, I will also say that these folks are doing an amazing job, and it doesn't take much now to light up a wireless internet service provider. So I'm actually building one in Honolulu with a friend. And the idea is you somehow figure out a way of getting a traditional commercial internet link into a location. Putting up a tower is not as hard as it used to be. In fact, there are actually crank-up towers that you can buy out of a catalog and crank it up and get a radio maybe 30 or 40 feet up in the air. And that's usually enough to go and serve a fairly good-sized neighborhood. So we've got lots and lots of mom-and-pop shops. In fact, I met a lot of them at Wispapalooza, where they're just trying to light up their neighborhood. And mighty good thing that is. Now, one of the other things that were happening that a lot of folks were worried about is how the heck do you get across large streams, small rivers, or lakes? And that's going to be interesting. So anyway, WISPA, the Wireless Internet Service Provider Association, is doing a lot of the education. So teaching people how to light up a WISP. In fact, I met a gentleman named Kevin Myers, and Kevin is a really interesting engineer. He does an amazing number of educational sessions at Wispapalooza, and he also does a whole bunch of them online, teaching people the basics. Now, there's actually two fairly good size corporations, manufacturers actually, that really and truly aim in on the small service providers. One is Ubiquiti and another one is Microtik, which ought to be really interesting. Now, what's happening is these folks are trying to take advantage of the unlicensed bands. So without having to mess around with all the specialized permits, these WISP are actually starting to bring up services a lot faster. In fact, the U.S. federal government is even providing a boatload of money for people bringing the internet, so bridging the digital divide, for Native Americans. So this has got to be fun. So I'm going to lean back towards the Microsoft project, and I expect Lou to squirm a little bit, hopefully not too much. But Lou, you threw this at me last night, and we both agree this is a great story. But how big an impact, how much have you seen of Microsoft resources being used to build these types of things?
So, you know, I personally haven't seen anything because I work in the office division, so I don't work with this group. But I have heard a lot about this program, and I can tell you that they have super ambitious goals here because they started the previous year, and they're looking to provide up to 3 million people, more people in underserved rural areas, broadband internet by July 4, 2022. So they have less than a year left, and they've been moving quite swiftly here. I think they've partnered with a lot of different private sector organizations and capital investment firms to make this possible. And that's really their idea here. The idea here is they bring together private sector capital investments and new technologies to help bring that technology and that availability to broadband in rural areas and to help with those financial and regulatory support there. It's interesting because they have three kind of pillars that they focus on. They're focusing obviously in rural America, especially. They're also focusing on areas for expanding in U.S. cities, especially in urban areas where they might not have good broadband connectivity, as well as in unconnected markets outside the U.S. as well, Saharan Africa and Asia. They're partnering with a lot of people in Kenya, I've seen actually, and for projects. So I think, you know, the interesting thing here is they're focusing on where the program needs to happen. Now I'm not sure if you can show this, Ann, but there's a really cool Power BI report. But the reason why I want to show it is not because of how cool the report is. It's because it shows the divide between what FCC is reporting on how many people actually don't have broadband versus what Microsoft has been doing research on here. And what it's showing is that 14 million, if you click on the next box down there where it says broadband, but yeah, that one there, there's the comparison, and it shows that the FCC is indicating that only 14.5 million people don't have broadband. But Microsoft actually, and their data indicates that actually the true number is closer to roughly 120 million people. So I think there's a little bit of a divide there, variance in what people have. And I think that's why programs like these will help hopefully bridge that. Now that, again, they're trying to do 30 million by next year. Again, that doesn't put a huge dent in the 120 million, but again, it's getting closer. So I think that this is a, I think, really great program, and I think we need more of them.
Yeah, and so I'm going to toot the horn for the WISPA group. There is actually a getting started. So Lou actually asked me a really interesting question the other night, and he says, how hard is it to start up a WISP? And the answer really is not as hard as it you might think. So even things like having to provision. So if someone goes and says, I want a connection in a building that you've already run fiber to, or you've run wireless to, or something, taking that router, scanning the barcode, getting it ready so that it has some address space and set up the billing and all that, that there's two or three fairly good size pieces of software that are available. Some are cloud-based, some are on-premise-based, or some are either, where you can literally set up a person's internet link just by scanning a barcode, sending it into the system, and it'll start provisioning. All the things that these giant ISPs have been doing fairly, you know, reasonably well, you know, they're good at taking your money. So the idea is, if someone wanted to start it up and to hit an underserved area, like for instance, my partner and I are looking at doing internet provisos for the 2 and 3 story walk-ups that have under 40 customers in it. And those are ones that a lot of the large ISPs aren't interested in because they can't make enough money. So I think it's going to be a combination of really cool initiatives like what Microsoft's doing. Even though Facebook has had some problems, they're actually doing some good stuff. Google's been doing a lot of good stuff. And obviously, the WISPA folks are doing some good stuff. So maybe there's hope. Now, one of these fine days, off in the not too distant future, we're going to go and have our wireless curmudgeon on, Heather Williams, a.k.a. Mo Beta Wi-Fi. And she's been delving into a startup. And I'm thinking maybe some new technology is going to be on the horizon very soon that's going to make it even easier for wireless internet service providers to get lit up. So here's crossing our fingers that we're going to be able to bridge that digital divide a lot faster. Now, I'm going to let Mr. Kurt have the last say on this article. And obviously, there's a lot of discrepancy between what the FCC thinks has coverage and what Microsoft has coverage, their study did. But from the large C-suite, what kinds of cool things might we be able to someday hold our breath for if internet really and truly did become ubiquitous? How big an impact, what kinds of impacts might we have on enterprise America?
Well, I think it could be a big impact. And I wanted to look at those two numbers, and you don't have to put it back up. But the FCC, if you looked carefully at their chart, they talked about the number of Americans where it was not available. And that's a relatively small number. Microsoft's number looked at the number of people who are not using broadband. And what that says to me, thank you, Ant, is that there is a huge gap covering about 106 million people where broadband is technically available, but it's not affordable. And to me, that's a critical thing. You know, we've talked a lot over the years about the digital divide, about the broadband gap, things like that. It covers both where it is available and how affordable it is. And the number on affordability is going to be different depending on precisely where you live. And I think in a lot of rural areas, we do get into that affordability gap because in many places, there are rural families who are able to live in a rural environment pretty well at an income level that is much less than that required to live in one of the big cities. So they may have a perfectly reasonable life, but not have lots of cash left over for $100 a month broadband. So what I am hoping is that through the wireless initiatives, through what could be part of an infrastructure deal if it ever makes it through Congress, through a lot of different new technologies, we can close not only the availability gap, but the affordability gap, and not leave people who are forced to deal with nothing but essentially dial-up speeds in what has become a broadband economy. Because while they may technically be part of this new economy, realistically, they are at best second-class citizens.
Thank you, Curtis. Good point. Very, very good point. Well, I think that puts that to bed because we need to get to our guests, because that's really our favorite part of the show, and I'm sure it will be yours as well. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's Thinx Canary. The last thing anyone wants right now is a data breach. Rather than a villain lying await, you have a hero. That's right. Thinx Canary is waiting for them. The companies usually find out too late that they've been compromised, and even after they've already spent millions on IT security and find out it wasn't enough. Now, Canary has completely changed the game here. It's designed to be installed and configured in minutes, and pardon the pun, left to its own devices. You don't have to think about it. Now, attackers prowling a target network look for juicy content. They'll browse Active Directory for file servers and explore file shares looking for documents. They'll try to default passwords against network devices and web services, and they'll scan for open services across the network. Now, canaries can be deployed throughout your entire network. It can make them look identical to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server, so attackers won't know they've been caught. Now, things canaries are designed to look like the things the hackers want to get to. You can put fake files on them or even enroll them in Active Directory. And when attackers investigate them further, they give themselves away and you're instantly notified of the breach. So you can also use canary tokens. Now, these are tiny tripwires that you can drop into hundreds of places. They follow the Things Canary philosophy of trivial to deploy with a ridiculously high quality of signal. Now, if an alert does happen here, a canary will notify you the way you want. Plus, you won't be inundated with false alarms. You can get alerts in any way that you want, whether it's email or text message on your console there, even Slack or webhooks, syslog, or even their API, and you choose the option that works best for your business. Now, it's important that companies know two things when it comes to data breaches. That's one, hackers will usually take the path of least resistance, and that's usually your staff, your users. And two, it takes on average 191 days for a company to realize that there's been a data breach. Now, that's too long, and Things Canary solves that problem for you. Now, people behind Canary have been in the security game for almost 2 decades. That's right. And have trained companies, militaries, and governments how to break in networks. And that's the knowledge they've used to build Canary. Now, Things Canaries are deployed all over the world on all 7 continents and are one of the best tools against data breaches. Visit canary.tools/twit. And for just $7,500 per year, you'll get 5 canaries, your own hosted console, upgrade, support, and maintenance. And use code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. You'll get 10% off the price for life. We know you love Things Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your canaries with their 2-month money back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit. And enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And we thank Things Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest who drops knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today we have Jeff Gray. He's the CEO and co-founder of Glueware. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Really glad to have you here. Now, we normally like to start the show with, you know, a really meaty question. That meaty question is, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us a short journey through tech and what brought you to Glueware?
So I'm going to make this quick, but this actually started in the 90s, and it started with our co-founder, Olivier Winvan, who was in Paris and studying electrical engineering, computer science, robotics, and cooking up all kinds of amazing automation capabilities. I, meanwhile, was at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo and managing a student-run research project where we were automating multi-vendor devices across the board, video conferencing, digital imaging and printing center, and then proving these in trade shows. And our paths crossed in the 2006 timeframe, and we happened to both be working at a virtual network operator out of London. And we put together a managed service offering that took some of the most advanced Cisco technologies, and we stitched together these technologies, route switch, security, DMVPN, all sorts of advanced features, and delivered that as a managed service. And we started to 400 times the bandwidth at 40% the cost, started winning against some of the largest service providers in the world. It was very, very hard to build and manage. And so the light bulb went off at that time, and we thought, what if we could automate this process, both for the provisioning as well as the upkeep? And from that moment, Glueware was born, the concept, and we bootstrapped and then raised funding. And I guess we'll get into the rest of the story, but that's really the origination of how we built and started Glueware.
That's a great story. Yeah, I think that it's interesting because a lot of times, a lot of organizations are built like this, where they center around a market need in order to make things easier, bring things down to a level playing field. I think you found one, and this is automation of networking and managing networks. Now, I do want to jump into that topic because it is a pretty deep and challenging one. Now, you know, obviously, in the last couple of years, we've seen an increase in a larger number of tool needs here because, one, you know, staffing is more remote, networks are getting harder, the perimeter of the network is changing, managing networks gets a little harder. There's lots of things going on here. Can you maybe take us through the landscape and what you're seeing?
Well, everything changed when COVID-19 hit, and overnight, all the traffic patterns changed. We broke the on-premises seal. the ability to go out and touch equipment is not there because folks are working from home. Supply chains have been impacted. All of a sudden, security has become very, very important. We've seen some very large scale breaches like SolarWinds, Kaseya, and others in the supply chain side. And, you know, there's a lot of businesses that are affected. You couple that with cloud and you take both on-prem and legacy and traditional, then you go cloud and all of a sudden you have this very ethereal network that you need to try to figure out how to manage. And traditionally it's been done manually. And the way that a lot of enterprises have been trying to address this problem is by scripting and building their own DIY, roll it your own software. And all of a sudden COVID-19 hits and what are you going to do, right? If you saw off the branch in which you sit, you've just broken the network. All of a sudden now you have all these remote users. Traffic patterns have flipped. The network has become more critical now, especially intertwining security and performance and not having outages or not having widespread breaches. And there's been a number of them that are even up to the billion-dollar level and taking down Fortune 100s. How do you prevent that? Because that is so critically important in today's world. So all of a sudden, the urgency of network automation has come front and center to CIOs and CTOs.
Now, when you talk about front and center, what are some of the things you're seeing that require automation right up front?
Patching, perfect example, right? Just very basic. You would think that push a button on the network side and you could patch your network. That's just not the case. It's very different than patching an endpoint or an iPhone or an Android or an Apple or you know a Lenovo. It all these network devices are so interconnected. And they're very, very temperamental. And order matters, validation matters. If you try to just script an update or even use some of the vendor tools, they don't work and you can actually break the network at scale. So that's one example. Another example would be compliance and audits and just making sure that you know that all of the CVEs that are out there that are coming from NIST and the known attacks and zero day, that they're patched rapidly. And most enterprises, especially larger enterprises, just don't have the ability to go out and they're still painting the walls before the next zero day, the next CVE, the next PCert comes out and they're starting over. So the amount of vulnerability that's out there in the real world is quite phenomenal and it's unfortunate.
I think that SolarWinds is actually a pretty interesting one because they obviously have their own patch manager. They manage being able to patch your systems and for Windows, and they have Linux and Linux tools out there too. Now, where are we? You know, obviously patching one big issue, but we're seeing a lot of other issues too, right? We're seeing not only patching issues, but there are some front and center issues that we're seeing in regards to, let's say, policy management or security and authentication management across the network and organization. Are you seeing any other big issues, kind of big bucket items that some of the organizations need to look for?
It is incredible how much networks have diverged from the paper standards and the way that security believes the network is. And due to either manual change and changes not sticking, due to troubleshooting. For example, what do you do the first, as soon as you're troubleshooting a bug or a vendor error, you're going to start removing security restrictions to try to diagnose and fix that error. This is common throughout the industry. Reapplying all of the security restrictions and policies back on manually, where you can accidentally create an error, or if you script and the script does not have validation, is not idempotent, is not declarative, did that change across 1,000 or 10,000 devices, or that ACL removal and then reapply, did that really stick or did it not stick? How do you know? And so the amount of deviation that's happened is very, very scary. And the enterprises need to fix that, and that's, you know, it's a big part of our value proposition of how we can bring companies back to compliance and back to standard, and they don't even know that they're out of standard, which is amazing.
Right. I mean, the interesting, there's actually a interesting vulnerability that lies kind of like sleeping here, which is obviously patch manager is a big item, and so you're running to patch firmwares and so on. But what about if there's vulnerabilities that end up creeping up in firmware? Do you have ways to to flag that, to manage that kind of thing?
Well, this happens often, and thanks to CVEs and NIST and pCERTs through vendors actively looking and finding and then you know, issuing these advisories, figuring out what vulnerabilities are there and then how that relates to the network and what's live on the network, and having a real-time source of truth that is not some Excel sheet or something, some CMDB that's offline and doesn't really, you know, it really doesn't have the ability to have a two-way conversation with the actual devices, whether they're physical or virtual or cloud or controller or traditional. Okay. But if you have a real-time awareness of what vulnerabilities are actually there and then on your network, that gives you a much better idea of what action you need to take. So oftentimes just understanding your environment is very helpful, so you take the correct actions.
Right. Now, you know, I've been reading a lot about, you know, a lot of organizations that are in different physical locations, whether they're hybrid cloud, they have an on-prem or even a, you know, in the cloud set of network or infrastructure. What are organizations doing to manage those and to ensure that they're kind of up to date in all things network for those types of networks?
I believe that there's a few answers. One would be manual. One would be the way that it's always done, which is engineers and CLI, command line, and logging into devices, device by device, and typing commands, and more of a set it and forget it type of approach, which is certainly not best practice. But there are many organizations that are doing that. The next class of organizations are in the middle of building their own software. So Python, Ansible, creating playbooks, really trying to build their own scripts and build something that they would then maintain and roll out. And there are significant challenges in doing that. It is possible, especially if you're a web scaler, you're a Google, you're a LinkedIn, you're a Facebook, you're a Goldman Sachs, for example. If your core business is software and you decide to go all in, then it's possible to self-build and self-fund this type of layer and create automation. Now, for the class of businesses and the overall mass market, where their core business might be financial transactions or maybe pharmaceuticals or maybe engineering, self-building your own software inside of every Fortune 500 or Global 2000 or even the layer below, the group below, is very, very difficult to get that staff and even to get going. Once you get going, you have to maintain and you have to build this, and then you have to feed that monster and make sure that the house of cards is not going to fall down. And it is very possible, but it takes a lot of work. So then the third class of customers are those that either have tried and they've only been able to scratch the surface, and they may be doing some sort of task-based automation on the network side, but they haven't yet been able to achieve full automation throughout the fabric, okay? Or they're sophisticated from the perspective that they've seen others, such as Merck, such as MasterCard, such as EY, such as Terracon, Acuity Insurance, other customers like this that have gone out and realized that they don't need to rediscover fire and reinvent the wheel, that there is a turnkey, rapid time to value, highly intelligent layer of automation that they can get out of the box functionality and then customize. And those would be the class of customers that are leveraging Glueware. And so that's the way we look at the market and what our customers are telling us.
Fantastic. Well, we have a lot more to talk about, but before we get to all that and before we bring my co-host back in, we do have to thank another great sponsor of this week at Enterprise Tech, and that's CrowdStrike. Now, you've probably seen the headlines. We talk about it here on Twit all the time. Ransomware attack after ransomware attack holding businesses hostage. It can feel like it's only a matter of time before they come for you, and you'll have to decide, do you pay or do you lose everything? But you can have a third option. That's right. Do you defeat your adversaries before the fight even starts? It's a good question. Now, with CrowdStrike, you're not alone in the battle against ransomware. Now, secure future demands a shared defense, and that's why CrowdStrike's Falcon platform uses their threat graph powered by advanced AI to analyze behavior on your devices, servers, and cloud workloads to find the threats and stop them. Now, their security platform delivers the industry most powerful set of tools to fight today's more sophisticated cyber attacks out there, all delivered via the cloud through a lightweight, intelligent agent. Now, Forrester's study finds Falcon Complete delivers a 403% return on investment with 100% confidence. Now, CrowdStrike harnesses the power of every click, every action, every ally to grow stronger and stop cyber threats before they can stop you. Now, Falcon Complete stops breaches every hour of every day through expert management, threat hunting, monitoring, and remediation. And it's backed by CrowdStrike's breach prevention warranty. They don't just say it, they guarantee it for Falcon Complete managed customers who receive a warranty covering them up to $1 million in the event of a breach. Terms and conditions apply. Now, we talked with CTO Michael Santonis, and he explained what makes CrowdStrike different and sets them apart from others.
I think what makes us unique is we've always tried to stay true to our mission to stop breaches, and today it's never been more relevant. When CrowdStrike was founded a decade ago, organizations and governments were being breached and technology that they were using was not protecting them. So our goal was to build the fundamentals that organizations need to defend themselves and to stop breaches. And that is everything that we focus on. We focus on the customer, we focus on stopping breaches, and we make sure that we continually innovate to stay ahead of the threat for the benefit of our customers.
Join the fight and experience the power of Falcon Platform for free today at CrowdStrike.com/twit. That's CrowdStrike.com/twit. CrowdStrike, because what we built together is worth defending together. And we thank CrowdStrike for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Jeff Gray. He's CEO and co-founder of Glueware, especially around network management, network automation, and that automation for management, managing your network. But I do want to bring my co-host back in because there's a lot to talk about here, and I want to get the different perspectives of the co-host. Let's start with Curtis.
Well, you know, I'm curious because I think it's great. Everyone I talk to says that automation, especially automated configurations and automated patch management, are critical for security. My question, though, is how much of the overall cybersecurity problem can be solved with what is essentially a reactive approach with this? I mean, obviously, if you're looking at CVEs to pull patches and things like that, it's of necessity reactive. Do you think that having what you have on offer improves the ability of network administrators to be proactive in their security?
I think it's an absolutely wonderful question. And there's two answers. There's what we're doing now, and there's what we're working on with our customers and where we're going. So let me share what we're working on or what we're delivering now. First of all, Glueware solves the reactive side, okay? And so a lot of, especially our Fortune 100 customers, they have built a lot of detection capability. They have some very, very sophisticated understanding of when there are attempted breaches, with the attack vectors, but it's still a manual process to go out and make changes to their minimum security baselines, to their gold standards, to be able to deal with the attack vectors. It is a manual problem that we're solving. When they go out and are building SOAR security orchestration, automated response runbooks, there's a lot of manual work in scripting those. And because they're script-based and they're not idempotent, it is possible to break the network at scale. And so, yes, there's a kill switch, but there's no green button to be able to turn everything back on. Now, the core invention of Glueware and the intellectual property is this intelligence. And where we stand alone in the industry is that we understand the state of the network, the configurations, the health. We compare that to a data model, the golden state, the intended state. We have an intelligent two-way conversation with every device. And we're able to process that data model and then make those changes, even 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 pushing a button, and guarantee that the change will be successful. Or if not, then it can roll back that there happens to be a vendor bug or a vendor issue. Now, what are we doing? We're building the foundational building block for self-operating. And nobody is going to go out and build their own self-driving car, maybe 64 Mustangs and things like that, but no one's going to build their own self-driving Tesla. This foundational building block that we have is the core to self-operating for the future, layering on AIML, layering on working with our enterprise customers, going after all the low-hanging fruit, and proving both reactive as well as proactive. This is where we have a significant advantage because of our core invention. So hopefully that explained our approach and where we're going.
Oh, absolutely. And my follow-up question deals with something that you said when you were talking about the manual processes that are involved in physically remediating some of the issues that are discovered, or physically building the playbooks that the SOAR solution depends on. When you talk to your customers about where they ultimately want to go with your product and products like yours, do they tell you that they are trying to augment the effectiveness of their human staff, or are they already looking to replace human network administrators wherever possible, whether it's to deal with very fast moving problems or to deal with the problem of skill shortages that we keep hearing about? So augment or replace, which seems to be more on their plate?
Everything that we have seen with our customers is that they have extreme shortages in labor, in people. There's no shortage of tasks to do. And so this is a pure augment capability that they want to take their valuable team members and not have them do monotonous copy and paste 1,000 times, or if you have multiple controllers, to go out and have to deal with template sprawl throughout an SD-WAN or, you know, a Meraki cloud, for example, and have all these different templates or all these API calls, or moving the problem from CLI and all of a sudden now, okay, let's maintain scripts. It's kind of another form of manual. And so this is about architecture. It's about enabling the operations teams to go out and make changes at scale in a safe and predictable manner. Now, the piece about folks where they happen to maybe be paying too much to manage service providers, okay, and they have the ability to renegotiate their contracts with managed service providers and be able to go out and even arm the managed service providers with more technology. It doesn't take 6 months to make a global change anymore. It takes less than an hour across 20,000 devices. I mean, that changes the game of what they can do and how they can patch and how they can make policy changes and deal with zero-day issues and deal with attack vectors. And so at this point, it's been all about augment, but take some of the fluff out of where they just happen to be paying these statements of works from MSPs that aren't really bringing business value to them. So that's the what we're seeing at this point.
You know, Jeff, I want to kind of go in a slightly different direction. I've been the network architect for a goodly number of networks. And one of the things a lot of us have been using is GitHub. In fact, that was actually a very large part of a conversation at the last Internet 2 conference, where network administrators are having to use GitHub just to keep track of different versions of ever-increasing complex configurations. Now, you mentioned your website mentions modeling, and on my wish list is, gee, I wish as I'm making these, you know, proposed changes, that if something could be looking at my proposed configs to find out if I'm implementing, say, something that's CVE such and such, or a known problem, how far does your model go, and does it account for variations within the hardware? So, like, I may have a Cisco and a Juniper set of switches and maybe HPE switches, and they all act a little different. Does your model take into account the differentiations between different pieces of hardware?
That's the magic. Absolutely. And that's where enterprises have traditionally struggled, because you have your Cisco, your CCIEs, you have those that are trained with Aruba, HP, with Juniper, Junos. There's just a lot of differences. And enterprises that either have a mixed environment or they happen to go out and grow by acquisition, but they still want to manage and put their minimum security baselines and their golden configs and be in compliance and be able to patch at scale without retooling their entire team or retraining and all that. That's where we come in. So it's about understanding what's out there. And the first step is discovering and then understanding. And that source of truth I talked about, it's multi-vendor. We've got 30 plus vendor operating systems across traditional, across API, across cloud. And then being able to understand the violations, and then to be able to cleanse those and bring it back to standard, and then set the capability to keep it clean and be able to change that scale. So normalizing, as you said, all the different vendors and making it both platform as well as vendor independent in an abstracted data model. I mean, that is the invention. That is the capability of Glueware.
Oh, that sounds awesome. Now, I would have loved to have had this when I was on the team that managed a very large classified network across the Pacific. And one of the problems we discovered is sometimes things act odd when you're separated by multiple time zones and you're trying to push things out over sometimes relatively slow links. Does your modeling have the capability of kind of tweaking this so that you roll it out in a more logical fashion so that the changes aren't going to be one big slam? So if you have an error, say in time zone plus two, and it's a problem, can you roll it back with that kind of granularity?
Absolutely. And we work with a lot of engineering firms that happen to be in very remote locations. We haven't gone as far as the Antarctica and others at this point, to my knowledge, but very remote locations over satellite, for example, huge latency. And instead of trying to do a load and pray approach where you come up with the template and you try to fill in wildcards and slam this big flat file or send a giant script that's one way that can either work if you do everything right or break things at scale, Glueware first goes and detects the state of the device, comes back and compares it with the data model, has that two-way conversation, and behaves as a network engineer, a CCIE in the cloud or on-prem in a private cloud, and it can deal with issues in latency and issues in response. There's a whole bunch of different defensive measures that are in there, so you don't cut off the branch in which you sit, roll back, you know, things like that. Now, I'd say the most important thing, just to sum this up, is that we have the equivalent of print preview. And so before you go and commit the change, you can actually hit preview and it'll process the data model throughout every end device. And you can execute a print preview of 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 devices, bring that back to with ServiceNow integration, for example, and then get that approved because you know that it's going to work and it's safe and predictable, and then commit the change as soon as the preview comes back. So that's the way we deal with this type of uncertainty.
Some amazing cool features. Well, folks, unfortunately, all good things must come to an end. Jeff, thank you so much for being here. We really do appreciate it. Now, we're running low on time, but we do want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can get started, where they can learn more about your programs, your offerings, and maybe how they can get started.
Come to our website, Glueware, GLUWARE.com, and click request demo or free Glueware or free trial. And we very much look forward to working with you. We live for our customers and helping our customers create value. So thank you.
Thanks again, Jeff. Well, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. Definitely tune your podcast to Twyatt. We do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you and get a hold of you?
You know, I wish I had had your product back when I was chief computer scientist, GSA Office of Information Security. It would have made my life so much easier. Anyway, you know what? Y'all have been sending me some great show ideas, and I'd love to keep hearing them. Now, do me a favor, though. Send the pitches, you PR people. That's who you're I'm talking to. Send your pitches to Chebert, Cheebert at twit.tv. Mr. Liu loves to hear them, but Mr. Liu has a day job. I'm retired. So let me sort them out and share it with the rest of the gang. Now, if you want to ask a question of the whole Twiet gang, send it to Twiet at twit.tv. And you know, we've had all kinds of people asking us, you know, things like, I'm just getting started. How, you know, what are your suggestions? Or I want to migrate from operations, you know, over to SecDef, you know, things like that. We'd love to hear from you. I'm also ADV, NET, LAB on Twitter, Advanced NetLab. So I'd love to hear from you, love to hear your ideas, and, you know, we are more than happy to share as much of our past experiences as possible. But the guys that keep asking me questions about classified projects, sorry.
Thanks, Cheever. Well, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin as well. He's a very active and very busy guy, but we want to hear about what's going on for you in the coming week, Curtis, and where can people find you and all your amazing work?
Well, next week, people can find me physically in Las Vegas at IWCE. If you're part of that community, look me up while I'm out there. I should be easy to find. I'm speaking on three different panels. After that, I'm going to be at attending either in person or virtually a number of different vendor conferences. I'm out and about. Send me some email. Send me a direct message on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA. Let me know what you would like to find out about the world of enterprise cybersecurity. Always happy to have input and questions to answer.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week and listens to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to our show and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiet. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, our show notes, co-host information, guest information, and links to the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos there, you'll help subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of those devices that you have and on any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. So definitely subscribe and join the movement. Plus, you may have heard about the movement, the Club Twit movement. That's right. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else, and it's only $7 per month. Now, one of my favorite parts of Club Twit is the exclusive access to the members-only Discord channel. I'm in it right now, talking with some people, posting some animated GIFs in there, lots of fun stuff. So definitely check that out. Some really fun and interesting conversations going on there, so definitely join the movement. Join Club Twit at twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, Club Twit now offers corporate group plans as well. That's right, group plans. It's a great way to give your team access to our ad-free tech podcast. The plan starts with five members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month, and you can add as many seats as you like. And this is really a great way for your IT department, your developers, your tech teams, your CISOs, your CTOs, whoever, to stay on top of the, you know, to date with access to all of our podcasts and all the tech stuff that we talk about. And it's just like regular memberships, but they can join the Twit Discord server as well and get the Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So sign up at twit.tv/clubtwit. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, family members, your coworkers, whoever, give them the gift of Twit, because we talk about a lot of fun tech topics on the show, and I definitely think that they will find them interesting and fun as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available on Fridays, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do this show live. That's right. We're on the live stream right now, live.twit.tv or twit.tv/live.
Come see how the pizza's made. Come see behind the scenes, all the banter we do, all the fun stuff we do here on Twit. So definitely check out that live stream. Now, if you're going to watch this show live, you might as well also jump into our infamous IRC channel as well. It's irc.twit.tv. Great set of characters in there. It's a little quiet there today, but that's okay. They normally are a very chatty and helpful and interesting bunch. So definitely chat, jump in there and be part of that fun group. Now, definitely hit me up as well at twitter.com/LouMM. I do have a day job, but I do love to talk to people like you and post some enterprise tidbits out there. So definitely direct message me there if you want to send me some show ideas if you want. Plus, I also like to just have great conversations about tech. Now, if you want to know what's going on in my normal work days at Microsoft, definitely check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There you can find all the amazing and great ways to customize your office experience to make more productive for you and your organization. Definitely check out Office Scripts as well. It's a lot of fun ways to customize Office Excel online and create your own macros in JavaScript and TypeScript. So check that out. I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we really couldn't do this show without them. So thank you to all their support. Also, thank you to all the engineers and staff at Twit. Without them, this show is not possible. So thank you for everybody and all your support over there. Of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chi one more time. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He does all the show bookings and the plannings. He takes show ideas. We really couldn't do this show without him. So thank you, Chibert, for all your support. Now, before we sign out, I do want to thank our editor for today, Mr. Victor V. He makes us look good behind the scenes after the fact. Thank you, Victor. Of course, we also have to thank our technical director, our TD for today, the talented Mr. Ant Pruitt. He does a fabulous show called Hands On Photography. Ant, what are you doing this week on Hands On Photography? Anything interesting?
Well, I think it was a little interesting. I took the crop tool and made an image bigger.
Ooh.
No, that's just a little bit of AI and Photoshop, but got some listener feedback and they asked, what would Aunt Pruitt do to this image? And I showed what I would do, and I think it turned out quite nicely. But yeah, twit.tv/hop.
Beautiful, beautiful. Now, you can actually use that to print out big prints of that too, right?
That is correct, sir.
Ooh, I might have to take advantage of that. Cool, cool, cool. Thank you for that. Well, folks, and until next time, I'm Louis Maresca. That's right. Just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, you don't have to wait till the weekend to get the tech news you need. Join Jason Howell and myself, Micah Sargent, for Tech News Weekly, where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.